Good morning, colleagues, members of the public. Welcome to this Friday, March 1st, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today is our governance day, but before we get to governance, we are going to hear a couple of bills have to do with kind of the transition of high school to university, college, and we'll hear those two first. Then we have scheduled a work session on the bill that we heard, I think, the very first week from Rep. Reed on the 529 accounts, and then we will move into our governance section. So I'm going to open concurrent public hearings on House Bill 2742 and House Bill 2898. Victoria, would you please describe these measures? And Rep. Gelzer, if you want to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2742 prohibits public university from discriminating against student on the basis that the student was not awarded a standard high school diploma or GED certificate. And House Bill 2898 allows students with disabilities to earn credit at community college or public university as part of transition services, prohibits denying financial aid to students for sole reason that student did not receive a standard high school diploma.
Welcome, Rep. Gelzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelzer. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I haven't had a lot of my coffee yet today, and I serve on other committees with almost all of you, so it's nice to see you. I'll be seeing you a lot for the rest of the day. The two bills are actually very different. Do you have a preference of which one I start with?
No. Take it your way.
All right. I'm going to start with House Bill 2898 first. So House Bill 2898 is intended to provide some clarification on some things I think we can already do, but people need affirmation that we can do it and that, in fact, we should do it. There's two pieces to this. The first is that if you are a student, and this is under federal law, who has not yet received a high school diploma, and you're on an IEP, so you are in special education, you are entitled to continue to receive education services until you're 21. So this set of services from 18 to 21 years are called transition services. And the students who are eligible for transition services, it's a pretty broad range of kids. On the one end, you may have kids with significant physical or developmental or intellectual disabilities. And on the other end, you may have kids where you would meet them and you would never guess they had a disability. They have an invisible disability like dyslexia. One of the things that we are going to start seeing more of are more kids in these transition programs. As we continue to make our high school graduation standards ever higher, it may take students a fifth year in order to earn that high school diploma. One of the things that's important to remember in the context of this bill is that across the state of Oregon, only 42% of students with disabilities, students on IEPs, will get a standard diploma. 42%. And what's really key to remember about that number is if you take all the students with intellectual disability and autism, and you put them together, of that total population of special education students, you're only looking at about 15% of the population. The vast majority of your kids in special education have learning disabilities like dyslexia. They have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or they experience some kind of a mental illness or behavioral disability. So these are students that, and I would argue that students with intellectual disabilities and others are also highly capable of earning diplomas in academic classes, but these are not kids traditionally that you would look at and assume they weren't going to get a diploma, but only 42% of them are. So what House Bill 2898 would do is to clarify that a student that is in that 18 to 21 year age range that does not have have a high school diploma could go ahead and start taking courses at the community college or the university, to start working towards a career certificate, to start working towards some kind of a degree. And the beauty of this is that education for these students at this age range is already funded. We are talking about a set of students for whom we have already funded education services. The kids are going to be more likely to continue to engage in this because a community college or university setting is a much more age and socially appropriate setting, so you won't have kids that walk away that say, I've done my 4 years of high school, I don't want to be here anymore. The other thing that's really important about this is some of these students may not be able to reach that math standard. Our high school principals earlier this week gave a presentation to the Corvallis School Board. A full third of our high school juniors are not on track to meet the math standard that they need to graduate with a regular high school diploma next year in Corvallis, where we have a relatively high graduation rate. And because of changes in the federal government starting July 1st of this year, unless you have a regular diploma or a GED, you are not eligible for any federal financial aid. No Pell Grant, no loans, nothing. So if you have these students that may be leaving with a modified diploma, and for some of these kids, because of the math, they may actually have AP history. They may have AP literature on their transcripts, but they have not hit that math level. They will be completely ineligible for any financial aid. If we can use that 18 to 21 time period and use those funds that we've already set aside for those students to enroll in courses, we can put them on track for a degree at a community college or a university or a career certificate that's going to open up the doors for economic independence for them later. But right now, the lack of that standard diploma is really kind of guaranteeing a lot of these kids a lifetime in poverty. Because of all of these changes, the door just slams shut if you don't have that regular diploma. That leads to the second piece of this, which is around the financial aid. The federal rules did, in fact, change. Until July 1st of this year, if you did not have a regular high school diploma, you could take an ability to benefit test, or if you already had earned 6 credits without federal financial aid, you then could be eligible for that. That is now changed. I was invited to meet with Senator Harkin's staff, who worked on some of this in December, and one of the things that we are talking about is reestablishing that that option of the 6 credits. So this would position us, if the federal government made that change, to have our kids ready for those that were pursuing four-year degrees. But we do not need to follow the federal government. We can make sure that our Oregon Opportunity Grants, that our Oregon-based financial aid is available to students who have been accepted to a community college or a university. So their ability to benefit has already been demonstrated by their acceptance to a degree program within a community college or a university. So in short, part number 2 is Oregon financial aid for Oregon kids who have been accepted to Oregon colleges. The first part of this is, if you're in a transition program, which is already a funded service, let's get you on track to 40-40-20. Let's get you on that career ladder, that certificate level with funds that we already have available. It's probably a better use of those dollars than kind of keeping kids sequestered in a classroom learning how to ride the bus. And are there any questions about this bill before the next one?
Colleagues?
I've got some questions or comments, but I don't know if we should maybe, because they're, even though they're different, there are some similarities as far as going into higher ed, so
yeah.
I may wait.
We do have a couple of people that signed up.
Well, maybe I should make my comments, okay. And then Reb Gelser might have a little better direction going into the other bill.
Sure.
You know, as I read through these earlier and then listening to you, I've got real concerns because of the K-12 responsibility. And our higher ed doesn't have that same responsibility. It's not the same funding model. We put money into K-12 unlike we do in higher ed, and their missions are different. Part of the mission and goal of K-12 should be to do everything they need to do for all students, whether it's gaining a modified diploma or GED or whatever. Higher ed is different in their goals, and the students that are there are different. We hear a lot of times, particularly with community colleges, but I think it's all of them, that, you know, their students are average 25 to 35 or whatever, and they are paying thousands of dollars a year to be there. And I'm not sure it's fair to those paying students in college to have any attention taken away from them to focus on people that should have been or should be being dealt with K-12. Now, I know I'm sounding harsh, but I wanted to throw that out and see your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman. I'm glad that you asked that question, and the answers are different for the two bills because these two bills do very different things. On the bill that I'm talking about right now, I would say that for this transition program, this is very akin to the same things that we are talking about around expanded options, where we are taking high school students and asking them to earn college credits before they ever leave the high school. In addition, for these students in a transition program, the tuition, and let me give you an example of how this might work. You have a kid in a transition program. Let's even take a kid with more challenges. You have a kid in a transition program that wants to be a cook. They want to be a cook. They weren't very good at math, but they want to be a cook. And they have a transition program at their local high school, and there is a culinary arts program at the local community college. It makes more sense for that student who can participate in that class appropriately and can earn that credit to take that investment that the state is making and have them take that course with something that's going to help them walk out with a career certificate. Now, the idea is very, very similar to my ninth grade daughter, does not yet have a high school diploma because, you know, she's in the ninth grade, and she has earned 2 college credits so far in her first semester of high school. She earned a college credit for childcare. She earned a college credit for theater arts. This is really that same kind of thing, that we should be allowing our students with disabilities the same opportunity for those expanded options as we do all students, including those that don't have disabilities, that aren't on IEPs. And we should especially be looking at that for these students that are more age appropriate, 18 to 21. Now, of course, each of these plans is going to be individualized because they're still under the purview of the IEP team. You aren't kind of throwing them off to the, and this is probably going to be community colleges more than anybody else, you're not really throwing them off to the responsibility of the community college. You still have an IEP team that is creating this appropriate plan and the appropriate supports for the student to be able to benefit in doing that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Along those lines, you kind of get to one of my concerns. It seems to me like we're taking authority away from community colleges, because the IEP team is going to go in and they're going to tell the community college what they need to do. And in what you were saying, I've always been very supportive of getting the dual credits and stuff down into the high school, but it goes back to my other point about it. It's kind of reverse. I support that, but when you have the reverse sending the students out, if would they have to pass the entrance exam to the community college or the university? I mean, it just seems to me like we'd be taking a lot of authority away from higher ed that is important to their model.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I don't see it that way, because this would work in the same way that our existing relationships work between school districts and community colleges. So I don't think you were still with me in the afternoon in the last school that we visited on our Portland day, but Jefferson High School, for instance, those students are high school students. They go over to the Portland Community College campus. Portland Community College retains full control over the Portland Community College campus and what it is that happens on that campus. You would not be asking the community college to change anything about the course that they do. This would be a student for whom the class was appropriate, that they enroll in that class for credit, just as you might have a 10th grader for whom that class is appropriate enroll in that class for credit. Because if you are talking about credit, it cannot be modified. If you are talking about credit, the student has to meet the standards for that class in order to get the credit. The problem that we're trying to solve are students that have the competence and the capability and the qualification information to participate in these classes and earn credit and currently don't have a really clear path to do it or are delayed for a longer period of time because they aren't yet 21 and they're still kind of stuck in this 18 to 21 system. And that population of kids is going to continue to grow. And you have to look again at our high school graduation outcomes right now when you only have 68% of kids graduating from high school and we want to get to 40-40-20, you have to figure out a way, how do we get that other 32% of kids on a career ladder? And are we going to say, you don't get to climb onto a career ladder because you were not able to complete 2 credits of math beyond algebra? And that's a pretty significant consequence, and for some kids, it's an impossible stair to climb. I think the last thing that I would point out before we go to the other bill is that Oregon is unique from other states in that many of these kids, if you're looking at who's eligible and who's not, we are the only state in the country that has statewide standards for modified diplomas. So in a lot of places, you get a modified diploma, that's kind of like a certificate of attendance. You showed up. In Oregon, we call that an alternative certificate. Here, these kids are going to have transcripts that show you the courses that they took. It's going to show you their math, their science, their history, their social studies, and you're going to be able to see on the transcript what was modified and where did they meet all of the standards in that class like any other student. So this one, and I'm a little bit worried about having the two bills on the same day because they're two different questions. On this one, it really is a clarification. I don't think there's anything in current law that prevents financial aid to be given to a student that has already been admitted. This doesn't talk about admission. It's just the Oregon financial aid for qualified students who have been admitted. And we had clarification on the record last session that was the case, that students are being denied. The first piece really is a clarification of, we're not going to say you can't participate in extended options just because you're on an IEP or because you're older, because you're 18 instead of a ninth grader. It really would be only those students for whom it's appropriate. Some of these questions I have a different response to on the other bill, which does something somewhat different.
Thank you.
So just again for clarification, so the first part of this bill would, is necessary because right now students who would like to stay in or enter expanded options while they're in transition are being denied. The second one is kind of a clarification of existing practice. You know, that is, you know, right now students with modified diplomas are not being denied the opportunity grant. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, that is true. And in the piece of the communication with the community college, I would point to the specific language in the bill where it really is more of a clarification for school districts. I don't necessarily believe that community colleges are turning kids away because we have some kids that are doing this well. There's some question about whether school districts are allowed to do it. So what this actually does is change the definition of transition services. And so it has transition services means, has the A, B, C that are what they currently are. And then D, maybe special education or related services, and may include earning credit at a community college or public university. So it becomes permissive to that school district to be able to work out some sort of an agreement with the community college. It does not mandate anyone to do anything, but it provides the clarification that is an allowable transition service and expenditure for the school district.
And just to clarify, expanded options, who pays for those? Is it the school district that pays for the college courses?
Representative Dimbro, in some places it is the school district. In some places where people have created their own thing, sometimes students participate in that. I know in our case for our daughter, we paid a fee at the beginning of the year that covered all of the credits that she might take, and there were scholarships available for students who could not pay that fee, and I think it was something like $15 or $30.
Mm-hmm. So this bill would not require the colleges or universities to pick up the cost of the students' attendance. Is that right?
Representative Dimbro, that is correct. This bill really is about the responsibility of the school district and what the school district may include in a plan.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Gorsuch, you had a question?
Well, just to follow up on what Rep. Huffman was talking about, for both of the bills, and maybe more for the second bill, I've heard some concerns from higher ed groups that it's It's not that they don't want to do this, but that they feel that it's coming back to a mandate that perhaps is not appropriate for higher ed, as it might be for K through 12. What would your response be to that?
And Representative Dimbrough, Representative Gorsuch, I would prefer to answer that question in the second bill because I don't believe that it applies to this bill.
Okay.
Why don't we move on to
unless that? You think it applies to this bill.
No. Mr. Chair, that's fine with me.
Let's hear about the second bill, and then Rep. Gorsuch can decide if he thinks it applies.
Thank you very much, Chair Dimbrough. So I'm now moving on to House Bill 2742. So the genesis of this bill actually started during the last legislative session when there was a young woman in Ashland who had earned an Oregon modified diploma who enrolled in a non-degree pottery class at Southern Oregon University. The student participated for a while, participated quite well, and then was abruptly asked to leave the class. This generated protests from all of her classmates and across the university campus because the students who enrolled with this student said, "This isn't a problem for me. It's not disrupting my educational experience. It's great to have this other person who is in a non-degree program, not earning a credit, not requiring the teacher to change the way that they do things." And this individual was then asked to leave. What this bill talks about, and the response to that was that the university system went to look at how are we going to handle these things. And this proposed policy came out that said, unless you have a standard diploma or a GED, you may not enroll in non-degree or visiting or auditing classes. So this bill is not about degree-seeking classes. This is not about a place where you're going to get a credit. This is about being able to sit in on a class. That policy, that proposed policy, I believe, is too far reaching and will lock out far more people than I believe even the originators of that policy intended. Let me give you an example of the kinds of people that would be prohibited from auditing a class or visiting a class or enrolling in a non-degree program at a campus if that policy were implemented at all campuses. One of the people impacted by that would be me. I have no high school diploma. I have no GED. I have absolutely no high school credential. I dropped out of high school after the 10th grade. I could not, under this policy, go to OSU and take a pottery class. That doesn't make sense to me. I don't think that is right. What this bill requires is that a student that has a modified diploma or an extended diploma would be treated on the same basis as any other community member in being able to participate in an audit class or a visiting class, which means all of the things you wouldn't take a spot from somebody else that was in a degree program. There would have to be an available spot. You would have to pay the same fee. You couldn't be distracting or disruptive or any of those other things. But you cannot solely turn somebody away based on what type of a diploma that they have. The other kids that this is going to pick up, again, are some of those kids with learning disabilities who have had AP English, AP Social Studies, and they don't have math. It could pick up pretty much all people with Down syndrome who may very well be able to participate in a pottery class or listen to some lectures on American history that might be very interesting to them when there is room and they've paid the fee and they are not distracting. Now, there are a couple of arguments that I've heard about this. One is that people with disabilities can be very distracting. Some people with disabilities can be very distracting. Some student athletes can be very distracting. And we do not remove student athletes from universities after crimes have been committed or after golf carts have been stolen. We don't remove them. They continue to stay. I would argue if a person with a disability behaved in that kind of a way, they should be removed from the campus or at least dealt with in the same way that you might deal with a student athlete or a non-disabled student. This is not asking that disruptive people be able to participate. It is simply asking that you don't just look at the document a person has and say, this type of person, because they don't have a GED or because they don't have a standard diploma, are not allowed to participate in the community activities that are available to other members of a community in a public institution. Now, I understand the argument about not wanting to change classes and students that are paying and all of those pieces, and I would agree with that if we were saying you had to lower standards to admit students to degree-based classes or to classes that were going to end in credit. That is not what this is about. This is about visiting and auditing, and a campus would still be able to respond to a situation where a student was disruptive or causing other problems. I've also heard arguments that it would infringe on academic freedom to have to admit people with disabilities to participate in activities on campuses. I understand that disability is not a protected class in the Constitution. It's only protected in statute. But I do not believe that academic freedom should include the ability to discriminate against an entire class of people. Now, you could say it's not discriminating on the class of people because we're just talking about the diploma document, but the way that our high school standards are set up, that is going to be very difficult for a whole lot of poor kids, a whole lot of students with disabilities. So I believe that this policy will actually also significantly impact kids in poverty. If you go and break down that 32% of kids that aren't leaving with a high school diploma, 3/4 of them are low income. Those kids would all be denied under these kinds of policies. So all that this bill does is says you have to look at the whole kid. You can't just exclude them based on the type of document that you have. And I should be allowed to take a pottery class or audit a newspaper class, even though I personally do not have a high school diploma or a GED.
Thank you, Rep. Gelser. So I have a question. So, you know, the situation down in Ashland, that young woman was not prohibited from auditing the class. There was a concern about her behavior in the class, whether supported or not. And so, this bill would not affect that situation, right? Because, you know, she was allowed to audit the class, and presumably it was her behavior in the class that the instructor deemed distracting. So how would this affect that?
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, as I said, the idea for this came from the chain of events that were sparked by that incident. And while I would have a disagreement with what distracting behavior includes, like not knowing a color or touching something in a museum is not particularly extreme behavior, but under this bill, that university still would not have been precluded from removing that student from the class. The response that the university system had was to create a task force, and out of that task force came a proposal that said, because of this thing, don't let any student that does not have a standard diploma or a GED enroll. So what this says is you cannot deny them enrollment. If a student is disruptive, if a student is causing problems for the teacher or others, you would deal with that in the same way you would with any student. This is not asking for a special protection. It is asking that we not allow the university system to go forward with a policy that is discriminatory on its face.
So it's basically giving them a chance to enroll in the same way that any other student could for auditing purposes. Now, it is possible, and you know, I'm not sure what the current policy is at the college to which I now just occasionally teach at. But the decision to allow a student to audit a class was an instructor's decision up front, and that presumably would not affect that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, presumably this would not impact it, but hopefully what it would do is put some sort of a statement in statute that just as you, as that teacher should not be making a determination based on skin color or religion or income, they should not be making a decision based on that type of diploma, which is likely predictive of income and disability of the student.
That's great. And I will say, kind of in the real world there, an instructor is probably not going to know what kind of diploma the student has. You know, the student signs up and, you know, there's just a decision of, can I take this extra person, you know, sitting in. Rep. Greenlick and then Rep. Gillen.
Good morning, Representative. I have a couple of questions. This bill is not about admitting students into the universities or colleges, it's not.
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Greenlick, that is correct. This is just about auditing or non-degree participation in campus activities.
And the non-degree participation isn't in the community college, for example, has some classes that are meant for learning particular things, but not a part of a credit. are we talking about credit classes? People taking classes that are SOCE 201 for 3 credits, auditing that class, or are we talking about classes that are more vocational? I'm not sure how to differentiate. I just had a notion of a person auditing a class, but those classes that we're talking about here are classes that are part of the regular degree program of the universities. Is that?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Greenlick, this talks about a student, it says, including the may not refuse application to or enrollment or participation in any campus activity, including the ability to audit courses offered at the university. So it's auditing and non-degree credit is or non-credit. So and I'm happy to work on an amendment that makes that very clear. We're not asking that students be eligible to earn credit. I don't know that we would want to preclude students from offering classes that otherwise might be eligible for credit. So take a community college, for instance, that offers extended lifelong learning classes. And there might be a cooking class. A student that is enrolled in the university might get credit for that cooking class. A student that doesn't have a regular diploma might really benefit from that cooking class because they're interested in cooking and they need to know how to cook in their daily lives and they can participate in that in a way that doesn't require.
Well, I was thinking about pottery class, which might in fact have been a class for art majors that would be required as a part of a degree for art majors, not a community, I forget what you just called it.
So, Chair Dimbrough, Representative Greenlick, that could be true, but the university had opened that class up and allowed members of the community who were not pursuing any degree to participate. So the key here is if the college or the university has opened that class up to members of the community who are not enrolled in the university as a degree-seeking student or a credit-seeking student, these students must have access on the same basis. If it is closed to non-degree students, then it's closed to these students as well. But if a retired person could go and take the class for fun, then we would not deny a person on the basis of the type of diploma that they have.
Okay, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Chair. As usual, I am impressed with your sense of fairness. I'm glad you're here. I want to clarify, this is without coffee. Is that correct this morning?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Gilliam, my almost completely full coffee cup is back there next to Bob Jundeff. And I hope he has not stolen my coffee.
Mr. Chair, we have others that are going to testify from higher ed. Because I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about your conversations with institutions about this and the possibility of conversations that would lead to these kind of changes in policy without the need for a statewide bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I first heard about concerns about this from the university system yesterday, and I really appreciated that, and then some clarification this morning that there was still concern. We talked about an amendment that really clarified the non-degree. I would argue that we need this statute because the report that came out following this was so disappointing, and if we were talking about moving towards independent governance, I don't think that we can move forward allowing discriminatory statements. And again, this is such a simple request. It is not saying you cannot remove a student that's disruptive. As the chair pointed out, it wouldn't necessarily even help the young woman in Ashland at Southern Oregon University. It really is, give a chance. If it's open to the rest of the community, we're not going to shut a door to you. And I don't know that I am not comfortable having a public university system that has a policy that is discriminatory on its face. And I believe it's appropriate in statute, given the problems that we've had related to this, to in statute make it clear that we don't want to discriminate against these students. Finally, the other reason that I think that it's important is that Oregon is unique because we have these modified diplomas that have credits that are attached to them in particular areas. And what's also important to point out is that this limits that to those extended diplomas and modified diplomas. It does not apply this protection to people that have certificates of attendance that just completed high school. They have to have actually left with a document that certifies that they have met specific statewide standards.
Thank you, Rep. Gelser. Could you get us the report that came out of that task force?
Yes, I can.
That would be very useful.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Just quickly, Rep. Gelzer, you had mentioned a cooking class, for example, for the ability to help somebody live independently. And have you considered all the programs out there? And I know you use cooking, but you've got in mind other things too. But we have a network of groups that do independent living training for folks too. So again, I want to point out that I'm not sure it's something that we necessarily want to go to higher ed with when there are other options out there possibly for independent living skills and other things.
So Chair Dembo, Representative Huffman, I appreciate that comment and I'm glad that you asked it. I think first of all, you have to look at the population of students that we are talking about. We are not just talking about people with intellectual disability where it's a matter of independent living. The second piece is that we have a mandate under the ADA around community integration. And if there is a community-based activity where you can take a class with your friends and your neighbors and non-disabled people, I think that that is always preferable. I don't want to create a system that says we send you over there while the rest of us sit here. Cooking is cooking. And I think cooking is one of those things that people can learn side by side from one another and together. And it would not be the same experience as being in a self-contained, segregated kind of a program.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Okay, I'm going to call up Roberta Dunn, Joe Holliday, and Bob Joondaff.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Dembro and Committee. My name is Roberta Dunn, and I'm from Beaverton, Oregon. I typically come far more prepared, but today I'm afraid I come far more passionate. And I will follow up with some written testimony, but today I'm just speaking from my heart, and I'll be told, not aware of what Representative Gelzer was going to share, in a sense I'd like to put a face to some of the student that might be who Representative Gelzer was sharing about. I happen to also be the executive director of FACT, Family and Community Together, and we are serving as Oregon's Parent Training and Information Center, supporting families raising a child experiencing disability and supporting families throughout the special education process from early intervention through the age of 26. I also am a member of the Think College group, and the Think College movement has been nationally pursuing opportunities for students experiencing intellectual disability to access post-secondary ed. And that's been a passion of mine since my son was in the eighth grade. My son Todd experiences Down syndrome and told me in the eighth grade he'd like to go to college. I immediately set up a lunch appointment with our director of special education and said, you know what, Todd wants to go to college. I think 4 years ought to be enough to make something happen. And I'm here today because my son's now 20. He has 1 year left in his transition programming. And though he is doing amazing and fabulous things, I have yet to break through to be able to allow him to access college in any shape or form, adult basic ed, non-credit classes, auditing, community college, or a college or university. I'm really excited about the governor's energy and efforts to de-silo our education system from early intervention through higher ed. And I think that the work that we're doing in tearing down some of those silos is going to make it so that students, instead of finding themselves on the slippery slope to dropping out, could actually find themselves on a slippery slope of falling in to college. We need to change the direction that our students slide. Right now, our structure is set up in such a way that our students are falling out of school. Let's have them fall into college. And by removing any of the barriers or hurdles that exist and creating increased access, I think we can do that. My son right now is, because of his wanting to go to college and watching his brothers go off to school, we have been very creative. Some would say we've been a bit rogue. My son, though he experiences intellectual disability, lives in a college house down in Eugene, 2.5 hours away from us, with 50 other students, none of which experience disability. He's utilized his brother as a skills trainer and has travel trained so that he could successfully get around town using public transportation. His brother also trains him on KP duty and house chores, which are a part of living in the college house. And he enrolled himself in the Eugene 4J School District's transition program. So that while he's living in this college house, not able to access post-secondary education, he is in the transition program down in Eugene. He's working very hard, and he's assessed twice at Lane Community College to try to access their adult basic ed program without success. And anything that we can do that increases opportunity for students, and let me echo Representative Gelser's point. I may be representing the perspective of a family with someone experiencing intellectual disability, but we have a lot of late bloomers that are currently dropouts and those that have just chosen not to pursue their diploma because high school doesn't work for them. And if we can pass House Bill 2898 and House Bill 2742 and increase their access to being able to take college classes, they could, especially for credit, they would be able to meet some of the requirements that would maybe help them access their diplomas. And I'd like to just close with a reference to a piece that's in the legislation that's also directly out of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Transition services focused on improving the academic and functional achievement of the child to facilitate the child's transition from school to post-school activities, including post-secondary education, competitive employment, independent living, and community inclusion. Those things need to happen, and they're more likely to happen when our young people can, as their peers do, transition into our local community colleges and into our local universities and colleges. And I think we will see greater outcomes for diploma acquisition, greater increased numbers of students prepared to be employed, and a far greater number of students prepared to live independently. Thank you, Chair Dembrow and committee. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I will follow up with written testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. We appreciate your coming in.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Has your son been rejected simply on the basis of not having a diploma? I mean, would this bill have changed the circumstances as well as that?
Chair Dembrow and Representative Greenlich, I can't speak to that directly because what we have found is that the process is so disjointed that we don't get formally rejected. We just don't hear back. I can't quite put my finger on it. I don't know if when the school program bills itself as one that's going to be for adults experiencing disability, as the adult basic ed program did, I assumed that I understood what an adult experiencing disability looked like, but yet my son doesn't seem to be a match, and so I'm not quite sure.
Thank you. Yes. Just following up on that, I don't know for sure, but I assume that if your son were a few years older, he would qualify for the adult basic education program, but he's in a kind of limbo right now. It sounds like, you know, too old for high school and not old enough, you know, for adult basic education.
Chair Dembrow, one of the things that we have found is that disability, especially something like Down syndrome, often enters the room before the person. So when my son arrives, people see an almond-shaped eye and a shorter stubby finger and a shorter, you know, stature, and they preconceive what they think my son would be interested in, what he'd be capable of. And we had to tenaciously fight for his access to general ed curriculum through school. Tenaciously, every year, being offered and being persuaded to try to take the life skills route through school. But my son is now a 20-year-old who can discuss with you the three branches of government, can talk to you about the environmental importance of keeping our beaches clean. He's a well-rounded young man. He actually discovered late in high school he loved math and was doing algebra his senior year, things he'd never have had the access to had we not fought for them. And so anything that we can do that increases access, if any Oregonian that wants to learn, don't we want our schools to have access? Don't we want our citizens, despite what they bring and despite where they might aspire to, an Oregonian that wants to learn should be able to access school. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Mr. Holliday, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve the Oregon University system as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives, and I also have the great pleasure of serving with Roberta and others on the Think College! Oregon Stakeholder Group. Their work inspires and humbles me, and we want to be part of the solution, and that's why we also will support the House Bill 2743, which would create a task force to study some of these issues more thoroughly. So my testimony was going to be limited to House Bill 2898. Bridget Burns, our Chief of Staff, has prepared some testimony on the other bill, if that's okay. All right. So I wanted to mention that in the work of the resource team that we formed, that Representative Gelser talked about, I was one of the staff to it. We actually looked at practices around the country in serving students with intellectual disabilities, and among those best practices, and I must say, were some, and I believe Rhode Island comes to mind most readily, that did use transition services and IEPs as a way to resource and pay for access and success in higher education for students with intellectual disabilities. So that's a model that we looked at that seems to work in other states. So we support that. The devil's in the detail, but we think that would be one way to go. In terms of eligibility for financial aid, I cannot speak to state eligibility. I know that we have someone from OSAC here, and Representative Gelser very thoroughly talked about the issues with federal financial aid. There's one, I don't mean to take you into the weeds with me, but there is one category where students with intellectual disabilities would be eligible for federal financial aid, and that's the TPSID program, transition programs for students with intellectual disabilities. And so there is a small category. We believe that Portland Community College either has or is pursuing that designation for their culinary assistant program. So there is one small category. Representative Gelser's point that eligibility for federal financial aid is barred for the students. And then finally, on the level of institutional aid, there really are no barriers to any student in a degree program receiving institution-based, need-based aid. That's just not a barrier. In fact, we don't even track or ask for the type of diploma when students are applying for admission into a degree program. If they're admitted to the program, if they're eligible for need-based aid on the institutional level, they'll receive it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions at this time? Okay. Mr. Jundeff, welcome.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. We provide legal-based advocacy to people with disabilities. Part of that involves assisting families and children in the special education area, as well as fielding complaints about violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The two bills that are before you today deal with two different areas, one being transition services and one being access to university services. On the transition area, I'd just like to comment that adequate access to adequate transition services has been a real challenge in Oregon and is a continuing one. In all areas of disabilities in special education, our laws treat people as unique individuals with unique needs, and that can run the gamut, as you've heard. And for some people, being able to access transition through community college can really make the difference in terms of their lives. And we know people who are successful in doing that, but there are some challenges, and so that is why we're supporting House Bill 2898. Getting to 2742, when the situation occurred that Representative Gelzer, and by the way, I'd like to thank Representative Gelzer, but also point out that as a former student athlete, I might have some concerns about some of her testimony. But,
Mr. Jindeff, would you like to reveal some of your past indiscretions that perhaps led you to perhaps be considered for expulsion? No?
I'd rather not go down that road, Mr. Chair.
Statute of limitations.
Thank you very much. And my memory is faded. But we did receive a complaint about the situation at the university, and we did an investigation. And I'd just like to make a few comments about that particular situation. One is that, of course, the Americans with Disabilities Act is really designed to try to make sure that people with disabilities are included as much as possible in all aspects of life. And university study is of course, a unique area because of the rigor, academic rigor that it demands and the grading that it brings with it. However, when we received the complaint about this particular student, we took a look at what the requirements were in terms of auditing classes, and we found on the website of the university that there was some statements about how they wanted to welcome people in the community. They wanted to break down barriers between the university and the community and have an opportunity for folks to come in and get some of the benefits of university study without being involved in the competitive aspects of grading and so forth. And when we started to look a little bit more closely, what we found were some disturbing statements by some involved that, in our estimation, were discriminatory against people with disabilities or making assumptions about disabilities that may not actually be accurate. And that, of course, is always concerning. We don't believe that this bill is asking for any special privilege for a person with disability. What it's asking for is equal treatment. And by equal treatment, what we talk about is looking at the factors that go into the program involved, creating criteria that are fair for everyone, and then applying those. And so in all areas of disability discrimination area, people with disabilities are not given special privileges. They're not allowed to engage in behaviors that other people can't engage in. They have to meet standards. What we're asking for is equal consideration. Unless there is a clear statement, as would be set forth in 2742, we end up in a situation where we have to look at each. We have to now get into an area that legally is very delicate. And what I mean by that is that when we have a standard that is that may not be appropriate in an individual's case, such as a degree, the one way to challenge that we have now is a lawsuit, and requiring a lot of experts, a lot of expense to go into that particular individual situation and whether that particular criteria is appropriate for them given the overall purposes of the course. I think that would be a tremendous waste of time, tremendous waste of money, and I think what this bill is really asking is for universities to look a little bit more closely at what the criteria are for participation of public and come up with standards that make sense for everyone. And that's why we support this bill.
Thanks, Mr. Jindeff.
Any questions? Colleagues?
Okay, thank you very much, panel. Thank you for your time. Okay, I'll call up Bridget Burns, please. And there's somebody from OSAC here. Could you come forward? Ms. Burns, welcome to our committee.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. I appreciate the opportunity today to speak to you briefly about House Bill 2742. We appreciate the well-intentioned motivation behind this bill. However, the university system does have some concerns that we want to put on the record. First, we have concerns about the ability to set enrollment standards. Because for us, the ability to set enrollment standards, even for non-admitted or auditing students, resides at the core of university's academic freedom. We're concerned about any effort that might erode the university's authority to use reasonable credentials for admission and enrollment and the precedent this bill might set for the future. Attainment of a standard Oregon High School diploma or GED with its essential skills requirement that equate with college readiness is one of several criteria that we use. The, quote, reasonable and probability of success standard is given to us by the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, which is our accrediting body. We have concerns in the bill about the use of the term discrimination in this proposed legislation, describing credentials universities may require for admission or enrollment of college-level coursework. An amendment that might eliminate such terminology would be a friendly one, and I have spoken with this about with Representative Gelser. Even for non-admitted students, an essential requirement is that the student possess the essential skill that reasonably allow the student to succeed in the university classroom experience. A high school diploma or GED is a reasonable proxy for success. These are common requirements for non-admit status for public and private universities across the country, and we do not believe they are discriminatory. Finally, OUS institutions are deeply committed to the success of our students, including students with intellectual disabilities. We are committed to their access as well. We believe more work can be done to help achieve this. This commitment is further demonstrated by a report that was circulated to you earlier this morning. I sent it on to Victoria, and I also just followed up with a copy, which is the culmination of an extensive effort we undertook to develop policies and recommendations that might improve the experience of students with intellectual disabilities on our campus and their possibility for success. Already, our institutions have many services, programs, and supports available to students with intellectual disabilities to ensure not only compliance with the law, but more importantly, the circumstances and conditions that make success in college possible. Critically, though, the law requires students with intellectual disabilities with or without a reasonable accommodation to be otherwise qualified for the academic program. If a student, even in a non-admit or audit circumstance, would require reasonable accommodation to succeed, OUS institutions will work with the student to find that accommodation. I want to finally conclude by pointing out that if you have any specific questions about our non-admit policies or admissions policies, our Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success, Joe Holliday, can speak directly to those. And finally, that the report provides for you a variety of recommendations that are suggestions for further review, including such things as the non-admit policies at institutions to provide clarity. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? Yes, Rick Greenwick.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask the same question. It's clear that this bill doesn't affect the admission policies for regular students, is that right?
Chair Dembo, Representative Greenlick, I'm under the impression that it is supposed to be directed at non-admits, so it would not be about the admissions policy for degree-seeking programs. However, usually those programs are run through the same office, so we're talking about the application of a universal standard to determine that a student will be successful. At the end of the day, the core tenet of the interaction between the First Amendment and universities is based on two things. One, we decide what we are going to research and teach. And two, we decide who we are going to teach, because we are held accountable for whether or not they are successful, for their retention, and for their completion. So those are all going to be in the same office that's going to make that determination.
May I follow on, Mr.
Yes, please.
And I've not read the bill very carefully, but Representative Gelser suggested that when a university, that this only applies, and I say I haven't read the bill carefully, when a university says this class is open to audit by members of the community without regard to their credentials, and or maybe an age credential, as some universities do. This only applies to that circumstance. It doesn't apply to you worrying about their completion, their success, their application of the degree, anything else. I mean, is that the way you read the bill as well?
Chair Demro, Representative Greenlick, I did speak yesterday with Representative Gelser, and she indicated a willingness to further clarify that within the bill. But yes, I believe that is the intention of the bill. I don't have a great deal of authority on the subject of non-admit policies and their impact on other policies, and I'm happy to bring Joe up here to speak to that. But yes, I do believe your interpretation is correct for the intentions of the bill. And just to add, we only have one institution that has specific policies about the type of high school diploma for non-admit programs.
Which one is that?
Southern Oregon University.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Yes, that's fine. You know, just following up, you know, when I think of a student who's auditing a class, you know, I'm not sure that questions of abilities to succeed are really relevant. I mean, a student who's auditing a class is there, I mean, ultimately is there as a more or less passive recipient, you know, is not producing work that the instructor is expected to grade, although some may well do it. I mean, I've been in that situation where I have graded audited work, but that is essentially the choice of the instructor. And, you know, it's often students will audit a class prior to taking it formally. You know, that happens just to kind of get a sense of, you know, is this a class that I could succeed in? But because, you know, a grade is not given and credit is not given, it's kind of different, I think, from, you know, other situations. So if this is really what we're talking about here, then, you know, I personally am less concerned about, you know, the adverse effects on the institution itself. Obviously, the person who's auditing the class cannot disrupt the class. You know, that would be unfair to the other students in the class, but, you know, depending on the class and the instructor, there probably can be a wide range of flexibility there. You know, I think, you know, I'm just thinking back to, you know, I've taught film studies classes where I've had blind students and I've had deaf students, and you might think a priori this is not going to work, but, you know, there actually are ways to make it work, and, you know, as long as there's flexibility among the class and the instructor.
Chair Dembro, we are committed to the success of all of our students, and we are willing to make reasonable accommodation for any extenuating circumstances or physical or intellectual disability. I would just point out that this is the difficult position. The bulk of our classes are not really about community outreach and teaching. I mean, this is just a rare circumstance where you would be talking about a ceramics class that is, I believe it was a 200-level ceramics class. Even most of our classes are just fundamentally different than what is typically provided at a community college in terms of service to the community. A lot of the core mission of what we do is about statewide and focus on the nationally competitive reputation of our institution. So it's just it's a minor difference, but yes, I'm sure we can work with Representative Gelser to work on the language to ensure that this bill is going to be as helpful as possible.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Burns. Mr. Brew, could you talk to us about the Oregon Opportunity Grant implications of the bill?
Absolutely. Representative Dembro, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I'm from the Oregon Student Access Commission, and we administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I don't really have prepared remarks, but I can just briefly take you through some of our initial thoughts. We don't see anything in the existing statute for the Oregon Opportunity Grant that would preclude students under 2898 accessing those funds, with one possible exception, because the existing statute says that the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the cost of education of a qualified student shall be shared by the student, the family, the federal government, and the state. We have not been unable to find a definition for what is a qualified student. So that would be our only caveat. In terms of practical implications, where we run into an issue is we use the free and application for federal student aid as our application process for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the same document that is used for the Pell Grant and student loans. And in that form, they ask, do you have one of four things? A, a high school diploma, B, a GED, C, are you homeschooled, or D, none of the above. And their definition of high school diploma is fairly strictly limited. So if a student who had a modified or extended diploma, if they understood the form correctly, would probably, by law, be required to answer D. We don't know yet whether we actually see forms for students that answer D, or whether that just kind of dies at the federal level, because those get submitted to the feds and then they feed us the ones that particularly apply to Oregon. We don't recall seeing somebody that has answered D before, and so we're investigating that. And the only other thing that I would point out is that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is distributed on what's called the Shared Responsibility Model, which takes into account, first of all, the students' resources and work and some level of loans, expected family contribution based on their income levels, then a federal share, and then the remaining is to be the state share. We would have to look at this if, under current law, our understanding is the Pell Grant and student loans are unavailable to students that have an extended or modified diploma. So the federal share, by definition, would go to zero. And we don't know. I think we could keep our state shares the same, but it would kind of change the model a little bit. We'd have to look at that. The last thing is that under the shared responsibility model, it's designed to be a sliding scale where you would have students with relatively high income, up to $70,000 family income, would get some small amount of opportunity grant. So students that had a much lower income would get a larger share. Because current resources can only fund about 20%, less than 20% of the eligible students, our Opportunity Grant Advisory Commission, which is made up of financial aid directors from community colleges, independent nonprofit colleges, and four-year state universities, has recommended that there be one flat rate of $1,950 for full-time students, and then half that rate for half-time students. And rather than being a sliding scale, it's kind of two tiers of students. So what this means, I guess, in terms of a transition student, is even if all the other stars aligned, if they're taking less than half time of the class load, they wouldn't be eligible for an opportunity grant under the current model of allocating resources. And that's all I had. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brew. And I'm not sure that the intent of the 2898 was to get those transitional students access to the opportunity grant. So that last point may not be an issue. The question of a qualified student, I mean, presumably if a student is accepted, you know, for matriculation by the university or college, they would be qualified. Is that right?
Yes. Barring some definition that I don't anticipate yet, yeah, Representative Dembo, right. Thank you. Yes, barring some definition that is not in my imagination at this point, yeah, I would assume that. Thank you.
Great, yeah. And the question of, you know, how to deal with the none of above checkoff box. So is that something you're working, now that this has been brought to your attention, you're working on anyway?
Representative Dembo, yes, sir.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And we'll return with a definition or information on that.
Excellent. Rep. Gallegos and Rep. Johnson. Rep. Gallegos.
Ms. Burns, you know, I made a list of your concerns, and I was trying to think through that. From what I'm hearing, this is not a four-credit situation. So the concerns about accreditation, I don't see those applying. Also, the standards for certification in terms of college readiness, again, I see this as a separate kind of situation for a special population. I do agree that maybe discrimination, you said you'd talk to Representative Gelser about that, and so the other things are, like I said, I just don't see them as fitting, but thank you.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the bill, I think, really has two distinct areas of subject matter. One would be access to some of the courses you were talking about, auditing, if you will, participating to some degree. Section 2 is really about access to financial support or financial aid for those activities. And I think practically, just from hearing what we've heard today, I think it creates, there obviously are some, not just state concerns perhaps, but federal issues as well that impact the availability or access to aid at the state level. And I think you and I would both agree that as we talk about going forward with the Oregon Opportunity Grant, it's highly likely that we begin to attach some performance or completion criteria towards eligibility for that as well, as we move towards not just access to higher ed, but completion either of degrees or certifications, you know, focused on workforce development and so forth. So for me, I guess, is what I'm saying is that if this bill only entailed Section 1, it might be easier to look at it without having Section 2 attached. I think it gets a little bit more confusing and perhaps a little bit more just hard to deal with it now in light of something that may change in the not too distant future. So I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I just thought I'd throw that out as a possibility. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. So you're suggesting perhaps an amendment that would split the two?
That could be helpful.
Or something along those lines. Well, that's certainly something that this committee can consider. You know, the question of, you know, whether or not the opportunity grant should remain as it currently is, just focus on the student's need and awards made on that basis, or whether it should also have a factor of greatest ability to succeed, you know, to have that sort of merit component, I think is probably something we're going to be wrestling with, you know, in this committee this term and this session. It's an important question, I think. I'm not sure that this bill necessarily forces us to make a decision about that. I mean, it sounds as if there's nothing really precluding. You know, what I'm hearing from Mr. Brew is actually current practice doesn't really bring that to bear, right? Yes.
Representative Jumbo, yes, that's correct. Nothing in our current practice would interfere with that. I'd like to also add that because we use the same application as the Pell Grant does require adequate yearly progress in order to continue to be receiving that, and so we use that same criteria. The legislature may, in their wisdom, decide to set a higher bar. That's at their discretion, but the Pell Grant does require that.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, both of you, for very informative testimony. And colleagues, we'll be looking at these. I'll work with Representative Gelser and people from OUS and the community colleges, perhaps with the help of the vice chairs, and we'll see what we're going to do with these. Okay, thank you. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on House Bill, public hearing, I'm sorry, on House Bills 2742 and House Bill 2898. This was a section of today's hearing that I thought would last a half hour, and you know how these things go, gentlemen. So with that, I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2299. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2299 requires State Registrar of Center for Health Statistics to send data file containing parents' names and mother's address to State Treasurer for each child born to Oregon residents, and State Treasurer to send notice to parents of opportunity to open college savings account. Directs Oregon 529 College Savings Board to establish account at request of parent. Establishes Oregon College Savings Matching Fund and continuously appropriates monies and fund to board for matching deposits to college savings accounts.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, as I mentioned earlier, this is the bill that we heard during the first week. Rep. Reed came and spoke to us about it along with representatives of the Treasurer's Office and of the 529 Board. So at that time, I think it was indicated that we would need a technical amendment to it, and we do have that before us. And I think we should have a chat about that, first of all. So, Rep. Huffman?
Chair Denbrough, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 8th, 2013.
Okay, Rep. Huffman moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 8th, 2013. Before we get into discussion, maybe I could call up Mr. Salvaggio and forget your name.
Mike Parker.
Michael. Yes, sorry, Mr. Parker from the 529 group. Just to explain why these Dash 1 amendments were necessary and what they do.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. The amendments are there. You're right, they're very technical. Because the records are coming actually to the College Savings Board, we wanted to make that explicit in the bill that the board is actually getting these records, not the state treasurer getting the records. So that's the reason for the amendment.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and I'd like to put on record that we did have a discussion with the State Registrar's Office about the definition of state agency and whether the College Savings Board was considered a state agency, as they did not want to set the precedent, and we agree that the records aren't statutorily given out to a non-state agency. It is our understanding, based on conversations with the Department of Justice, that the 529 College Savings Board is in fact a state agency, so I just wanted to get that on record.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So bad you. And before I open it up to questions, you know, in looking at the fiscal impact here, it's a very small amount, and I think we heard last time that the costs would be absorbed within the 529 program. Is that true, Mr. Parker?
Chair Denver, that's correct. This would just be part of our effort, our continued effort to outreach to Oregonians as we do now. So it's a small cost that we're happy to absorb in our current budget.
Right. And that cost, for the record, is $8,204, which would be a one-time data transfer setup.
That is correct, and we'll also absorb then the ongoing mailing costs out every quarter, which is fine.
Okay, colleagues, any questions of these gentlemen?
Rep. Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the good intent here, but has this bill... Has ACLU looked at it? Have we looked at other privacy issues? When you go into the hospital now, can the mother say, "I don't want this information released"?
Mr. Parker, has anyone expressed that kind of concern to you?
Chair Denbrough, President Wisnett, no one's expressed that concern to me. One thing I will tell you is that when these records are transferred to us for a mailing, then those records are destroyed. So we would never retain those records in our office. But no one's expressed to me, anyway, a privacy concern at this point.
Thank you. Yes, Sir Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who the question is for, but these costs, whatever the costs are, will be borne by the people who are invested in the account, correct?
Chair Denver, Representative Harker, the one-time cost to set up the account, to set up the transfer from health records to us is going to be borne by in my budget. So we will take care of that cost in our normal course of sending out marketing materials.
Where does the money come from for your budget?
Chair Denver, Representative Parker, our budget is borne by fees that are paid by participants,
right,
in addition to monies that we receive from our private sector partners to help us put the word out about the plan. So none of our money is general fund dollars at all. It all comes from the participants and from our private sector partners.
Okay, and what's the breakdown in those two categories?
The breakdown of those two categories, Chair Denbo, Most of our outreach efforts, I would say 80% of our outreach efforts are paid for by our private sector partners. Very small portion is paid through administrative fees paid by participants.
With these mailing, the charges for the mailings that you referred to before and the $100 matching funds come out of those private sector dollars, or would they come out of the investments made by people such as myself and everyone else who invest in those
matching funds? Sure, yeah, sure. Chair Denver, Representative Parker, the matching funds is a completely separate issue. The matching funds will not come out of any fees paid by participants. The only thing that would be paid by participants in this case would be our ongoing marketing efforts to put the word out about the plan, which this would get absorbed into that section. So again, most of that money is paid for by our two private sector partners that contractually give us the dollars to do the marketing efforts.
And Chair Denver, members of the committee, the expenditure limitation given to the 529 program is then one of the key performance measures on that the program pursues is getting a wider range, both in numbers and geography, of people joining the program. And that's not just simply to bump numbers, but the fact is that the more people in that pool, the less the fees are to everyone. And in fact, the Treasurer recently was able to negotiate lower fees for participants because that pool of participants had grown so much in the last few years.
Okay. Yes, Rep. Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sort of both interested and stunned by Representative Wisnett's constant haranguing on behalf of the ACLU. Is there a way that you know of where there could be, without unnecessary extra steps, for new parents to give consent for this kind of information to be sent?
Chair Denbro, Representative Gillum, on the top of my head, no. I think it would be difficult. I think at the very least you have to contact them to get their consent, and so we're already contacting them. So I don't really see an easy way to provide consent to receive this information. I will tell you just, you know, for the record that this is not going to be, you know, a hard sell. We're going to provide them information about what they can do for their child going forward, just basic information about college savings. So it'll be a general mailing to them, and if they want to participate, great. If not, we're not going to keep following up with them. It's going to be a one-time mailing about the program, and if they want to participate, great. We're happy to have them in, but we're not going to keep that constant pressure on them.
And if I could add to that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the records being forwarded to the board are not the entire record that the health authority will have. It's simply a name and address.
And just if I could follow up on that, I mean, it sounds like what you're proposing is sort of normal business operations. I mean, I think of when my kids were born. I got mailings from diaper services and other things. You know, I didn't give consent for them to send me their materials. It's the hospital. There's a sort of normal business operation kind of relationship. And I think also, you know, the question of who pays for the marketing. I mean, marketing costs for any kind of investment program are, in some sense, borne by the other members in the fund. So again, this seems pretty normal to me. Yeah, Rep. Wisnett.
Thank you. Ms. Parker, right, could you point out where in the bill it says the records are destroyed after you receive them and do the fish mailing? And also, you say the state register for the Center of Health Statistics, did they also provide a financial impact of what it's going to cost them or time?
Chair Denbro, Representative Wisnett, they did provide the fiscal for the $8,000 to set up the account. I am not clear exactly where it's in the bill. So page 1, line 13, it says, including but not limited to the transfer, storage, and destruction of data files. So again, we will receive those. What we're going to likely do is with the health statistics folks set up a process for the transfer and the destruction of those files. So that'll all be written down in a process.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Rep.
I think the intention is good. I'll consult with my legal team.
Great. Yes, Rep. Hockney.
Just a quick comment. From a marketing standpoint, you know, the most effective, Representative Denbrough talked about, you know, when our kids were born, we got all kinds of things. And, you know, the ones that seemed to stick out the most were something that had some kind of a sample in it. And, you know, you might consider what kind of a fob could you send with the mailing to actually, you know, be something that they wouldn't just throw in the trash, or but it might make them stop and think about. Yeah, I don't know what that would be, but you know, something inexpensive that you could pass along that would stick around a little longer than a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
yes.
What about a little tiny miniature certificate, graduation certificate?
That I think is an intriguing thought. My own thoughts were more towards likenesses of the committee members here, you know, and you know, saying that we want you to invest in Oregon.
Yeah. What an inspiration!
Really,
that would get photo of these old guys.
And Mr. Chair, my comment was serious. So,
thank you,
Rep. Parker, then Rep. Johnson, and.
Then we're going to have to move on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to investing in Oregon, just someone refresh my memory. I think these funds can be used for the person to attend any college, not necessarily in Oregon, correct?
Chair Jim Burbson Party, yes. This is simply a program that you had sponsored 12 years ago.
Yeah.
You can use the money anywhere you want, in-state, out-of-state, public, private, in the United States, and many schools abroad.
Okay.
It's probably too soon to tell, but I suspect that most of these funds are going towards students studying in Oregon.
I can skate some statistics, but most folks are using it for in-state public institutions.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the intent of the measure is to ensure that the parents of each child born in Oregon have knowledge of this program, does the agency have the ability to determine what language those parents speak and what language this notification should show up in their mailboxes in?
Chair Jumbo, Representative Johnson, good question. Off the top of my head, no. We will likely send everything in English at this point. I don't, as Mr. Spaggio said, we're not going to receive anything but a name and an address. We're not going to receive potentially the native language that person might speak.
Just to follow up, it would seem that in some parts of Oregon, we would be sending spam type notifications to people who can't decipher what the message is, so I wonder about the effectiveness of that, just to throw it out. If we're really trying to make this effective and reach the largest potential groupings of people out there.
Now, you raise a very interesting point. I'm sure Mr. Parker will take it under advisement.
Sure, we will definitely look at that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, is there any objection to our adopting the Dash 1 amendments? Okay. Rep. Huffman.
Chair Denbrough, I move House Bill 2299 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Huffman moves House Bill 2299 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, the motion passes. And I'll designate Rep. Reed to carry this bill. Okay, thank you. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2299. And I will open, what is this, an information session? Okay. I'm going to open an informational hearing on university governance. And colleagues, as I told you, this is our chance for Rep. Johnson and I to at least start walking you through the report from the Special Committee on University Governance, the Joint Special Committee on University Governance. And you received in your email and on OLIS the report that the committee issued back in October, and we would like to just kind of give you the background to it and answer questions about it To the extent that we can go through it in a section-by-section manner, in a timely manner, we won't get all the way today, but we'll carry forth with that next week. So, again, as a kind of background, House Bill 4061, which this committee created and ultimately it passed last session, a short session, created this joint special committee. And that is because universities came forward, in this case the University of Oregon and Portland State University, with requests to have their own university boards. This is something that, a process that began at least in the 2011 session, where we decided, in our wisdom as a legislature, to pass Senate Bill 242. Senate Bill 242 changed the status of the Oregon University system from being a state agency, and thus all their business processes had to follow all the requirements that any other state agency does, to being a public university system, free of the most burdensome of those business operations requirements. At the same time, the University of Oregon particularly was interested in further governance changes that would allow them to have their own board. They were interested in a board that was similar to the board that Oregon Health Sciences University has in a number of ways. And we heard last week from the president of Oregon Health Sciences University, and he told us what motivated that institution to seek to become a public corporation. Part of the reason that, what we heard was twofold. There were two motivations. One was that, that the Health Sciences University is a university, but it also, of course, is a hospital, a working hospital, and it was felt that having its own board would enable it to fulfill that mission better. The other is that at that time there was no Senate Bill 242, and so they were operating under all the constraints that a state agency has. They wanted to be free of those. Senate Bill 242 freed all the universities from those state agency constraints. But still, there was a sense that there could be merit in universities having their own boards for a variety of reasons. And so that's why House Bill 4061 created the task force to look into that. And we came up with a set of findings, and the findings then guided us in the preliminary draft that came before you in the form of House Bill, 2149. So I'd like to just kick it off, and then I'll turn it over to Rep. Johnson. And let me say in preface, I think our work on this bill was one of the best examples of co-governance working last session. I think Rep. Johnson and I worked together very productively on this, as we did with Senate Bill 242. Anyway, if you look at the first page of the report, it's here on your, it's here at the dais for you. What we concluded was that Oregon may benefit from having public universities with institutional boards, as long as the following principles are met. That these boards would, one, provide transparency, public accountability, and support for the university. That, two, another benefit is that they're close to and closely focused on the individual university. Right now, the State Board of Higher Ed oversees the operations of all the universities. Here, an institutional board could focus on the particular needs and missions of the individual university. But at the same time, and that takes us to three,
that the fact that a University of Oregon or a Portland State or ultimately an Oregon State University has its own board, that that should not negatively impact public universities that do not have institutional boards. That there is merit in having a system, and that, you know, somehow those merits need to be preserved, even within a context of institutions having their own boards. Four, that it should lead to greater access and affordability for Oregon residents and do not disadvantage Oregon students relative to out-of-state students. This was a concern that we heard, you know, from a number of people during the hearings, that, and particularly committee members, that there was a concern that if you have institutional boards, they're going to be more likely, in looking at the bottom line of the institution, to bring in more and more out-of-state students in order to get their greatly higher revenue that they would bring in. And so they would focus on the needs, exclusive needs of the institution, as opposed to the larger 40-40-20 needs of the state of getting more of our own Oregon students into the university. Five, that they're similar to the State Board of Higher Education in composition, constitution, and transparency. Okay, there was not a sense in which the current State Board of Higher Education has any problems. Right, people seem generally satisfied with the way that it operates, its transparency, the members who sit on it, etc. But what's being proposed is taking what's working at that level and transferring it to a more, you know, a level that's closer to the individual institution. Six, has a dual fiduciary responsibility to the university and to the state of Oregon as a whole, right? That, again, going back to what I said before, they're focused on the needs of the institution, but equally, they have to focus on the needs of the state as a whole. Seven, promote the academic success of students in support of the mission of all education beyond high school, as described by ORS 351.009. That is the statute that specifically calls out 40-40-20. And then on the other side, you know, further findings. There are economy of scale benefits to having a coordinated university system. Shared services may continue to be shared among universities. I mean, there was a sense in which shared services are good things, that they can lead to economies of scale, and it would be appropriate to continue them where appropriate. Three, a basic principle that ownership of all university property, whether created before or after the creation of an institutional board, whether through state funding, through university-issued revenue bonds, or through philanthropy, resides with the people of Oregon.
Question on that, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, let me just finish, and then I'll open all of these up for questions. That the Legislative Assembly has a responsibility to monitor the success of institutional boards at fulfilling their missions, compacts, and the principles stated above. That is, as we move towards creating institutional boards, if that's what we decide to do, we're going to have to continually monitor their success, get reports on, and make sure this is working. Okay, so now I would, just before your question, Rep. Johnson, do you have anything to add to this?
Well, I think it's important to, you know, provide the context of what was it that led to, you know, the whole discussion. And I think really it stems out of the passage of 40-40-20, you know, the aspirational goal that the state has taken on, coupled with a certainly much more intentional focus on public education in general in Oregon that began with the last legislative session. So out of that, then, some of our universities are saying we believe that we can be much more effective in providing more degrees to more types of students, and we can better serve our resident population as well as expand the educational opportunities and missions of the institutions if we have more autonomy, if we have more flexibility to manage our institutions as, from a strategic point of view, instead of being a part of a system that's monitored and is regulated by a central body. So I think that's kind of the impetus that led us to this point. So I think that's important to talk about initially. But the other point I would make as you go through, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, Victoria made this wonderful summary of the bill, and if members, as you read the actual bill, Victoria kind of capsulizes the summary here. It actually works very well to read, go back and forth between one and the other, so it helps to do that. But I would just say that regarding what you just talked about, which is basically section one of the bill, I think there's three main points in there that our committee spent quite a bit of time discussing, and some we had greater degrees of let's say mutual agreement than others. But one would be, I think, that everyone agreed wholeheartedly that whatever governance changes occur within the OUS system, that there shouldn't be a negative impact on the system as a whole. If we provide greater autonomy for the U of O, PSU, perhaps OSU, that the other institutions and in the wholeness of them shouldn't be impacted negatively in their desire to, again, reach out and target and to provide those academic services to whomever their constituency are. Secondly, I would say that the question of economy of scale is obviously, again, an ongoing concern and something that I think everybody agrees that the system as a whole benefits from economies of scale. So if you have a greater autonomy and independence on the one side, how can we still ensure that there are economies of scale so that the system itself can continue to be as efficient as possible? But third is the last one I think you touched on, would be ownership of university property. And I think there definitely are some differences of opinion there, providing that if via this increased autonomy and so forth leads to greater philanthropy or private capitalization of a university, should their investment of private capital continue to be managed and owned by the state of Oregon, or should that university have greater independence and autonomy for those type of investments that come in? Also, do they then have the ability to leverage or to, with the existing facilities, how much flexibility do they have to manage those in a way that can leverage additional capital and so forth, too? So there's some differences of opinion, not just within the committee, I think, but in terms of the greater education community at large that I think still need to be worked through. But that's what I would just touch on in Section 1 as kind of the main points, Mr. Chair. So
thank you, Rep. Johnson. Yeah, that's a very fair point. And, you know, as I mentioned last week, you know, it's my intention to sort of, over the next few weeks, break these down and allow us to have conversations around all of those. You know, for example, the question of the ownership of the property. What is appropriate there? So, Rep. Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll spend some homework time and dig in this too. I think that as you're going through the few things you did, I alerted also to the property, and that my background in ways and means immediately on that issue about ownership, I think the universities were in charge of maintenance. And that's not, so now if we own that, is that a state responsibility to maintenance? So we might want to talk about that later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Rep. Huffman and then Rep. Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that was one of my first comments that I asked of supporters 2, 3, 4 years ago when they brought this forward. It was, what about ownership and responsibility of property? So I think that's probably on everybody's mind. On the permissiveness for the other universities, the presidents would be allowed to bring forward, and Section 3 outlines what that process would be. Just curious, has U of O and PSU gone through that vetting process yet that is required of the others if they come forward?
I think our assumption was that over the course of our adopting a bill that would, grant institutional boards, they would have to convince us, the legislative body, that they were ready for that. And
so that's ahead of us then, maybe?
Yes.
Still? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And At that time, at the time that we drafted this, Oregon State University was not interested in having a board anytime in the near future. Since then, we've learned that Oregon State University might well be interested in having a board in the near future. And so, you know, as we are modifying this bill on its way, you know, to passage or not, we'll have to accommodate that, you know, in the legislation. So, you know, to create a sort of upfront approval of them if they do decide sometime in the near future that that's the route they want to go. Okay. And let me say one other thing, and that's, I probably should have said this up front. There is a Senate version of mm-hmm. our bill, and that's Senate Bill 759, I think. That's the number. Anyway, that is being worked, you know, as we speak. And I think it's likely that they're going in a somewhat different direction. They're taking it in a different direction than the Joint Committee recommended. So, you know, Rep. Johnson and I have been, you know, sort of involved in conversations around that, but we're, I think, both anxious to see what comes out from LC on that, which I think should be early next week. So we'll be able to talk about that to some extent next week. But it's a slightly different approach, one that's more aligned with the University of Oregon request. So, yeah, Rep. Greenlick.
Well, let me ask you a question before. Is the intention to work this bill or to wait for the Senate bill and work that?
You know, a lot depends on what happens to that bill. Senator Haass is hoping that that bill, they can pass it and then send it over to us. But there's, in my estimation, there's at least a decent likelihood that that bill is going to go straight to Ways and Means. Because it just seems to involve a fair amount of fiscal impact. But if it comes to us, then, you know, then we'll work it. If it doesn't, and it goes straight to Ways and Means, I want us to be able to, you know, to have our own discussion of this issue, which could culminate in our sending 2149 down to Ways and Means as well. Or not. I know that's still kind of up in the air. But the key is that we be able, as a committee, to really discuss these issues, these policy issues, and to hear from the public on these issues.
Yeah,
does that answer your question?
Well, it does. I'd like to propose an amendment. I wasn't sure which bill to propose an amendment.
Yeah.
I have two things that I want to put on the record. Maybe it's all the same thing. The State Board had a strategic planning process in place over the last few years, and it seems to me that it failed to produce a strategic plan. It seems to me this bill, well, and let me make the second point, which is probably the same. The thing that I'm particularly worried about is the plan for a strategic plan for higher education in the Portland metropolitan area. That seems to me such a wide open area now, with Portland State having aspirations, the University of Oregon seeming to create a University of Oregon-Portland and continuing to slice off pieces of the educational salami, and, if you will, in that case. OSU having some aspirations in the Portland area around a few areas. I really worry about this bill in its own right without putting it into some context of where we're going as a state and where we're going particularly with higher ed in the Portland area. I mean, the old saying is, if you don't know where you're going, any road gets you there. And if we don't know where we're going in a plan for higher ed in the state, issues of dealing with the regionals and how they relate to community colleges and a whole set of things, and a plan for higher ed in the Portland area, I'm very nervous about moving anything. I mean, any road will get you there, but you don't know where it'll get you is the problem.
So let me respond to that in two ways. You know, I think that, you know, from my perspective, something that happened to OUS in its strategic planning process was, you know, it really found itself focusing on these governance issues, perhaps to the exclusion of other important issues like what you're talking about.
I mean, like a planned vision.
Yeah, a real strategic vision. You know, they were focused on the, you know, what ultimately led to Senate Bill 242, you know, that you know, they felt that to move forward, they really needed to leave that state agency status. That was really important. And at the same time, to somehow deal with this question of local boards. And that, you know, those conversations just, you know, I think sucked up a lot of the, you know, a lot of the air in the room. I totally agree with you that what we need is strategic visioning around issues like higher education in the metro area. And I for that, I think, remember, this bill is not, we're not going to be considering this in isolation. We're also going to be considering that other bill, which is looking at the larger organizational issues around the creation of the new Department of Postsecondary Education and the role of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And under that vision, and I think where we're headed to here, is that the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, is going to be charged with looking at those larger issues that comprise both the universities and the community colleges, and even, you know, the independent colleges as well. And that to really do that kind of strategic visioning, you know, you need that bigger picture. And the route to get there is going to come through that other bill that we're going to be working on starting next week, March 8th, we're going to introduce it.
That's exactly my point. My point is that sets back a strategic planning process 3 years probably by the time they get organized and they come to the conclusion we ought to be thinking about where we're going. And this is moving things in a pretty dramatic way. I mean, it's essentially foreclosing a lot of the discussion that could happen. I mean, it's okay, here's where we are. I had the same problem with 242. It was my same problem there, that moving in that direction may be okay and maybe it's not, and the question says compared to what. So I'm mm-hmm. remain a little nervous about this whole process.
Yes, Rep. Gorsuch.
I share some of Rep. Greenlink's concerns, but I'm also very worried about the smaller universities. Is there any sense of how they will go in terms of institutional boards? Will they band together, do you think, or will they want to go their own separate way as well?
You know, I think that's a question yet to be determined.
Okay.
And it's either going to be determined under this legislation or through a longer process. Okay. But it's going to be really important for us to get that one right as well. And, you know, there are various options that, you know, that we could see. I think, you know, in the short run, what you're going to see in the envisioned in the larger governance bill is that the four teaching universities would remain banded together under a single board for the near term. Now, it may be that they may decide that they want separate boards, or maybe some do, others don't. That is a conversation we're going to have. So,
thank you.
Yes, Rep. Johnson. And then, but by the way, I would propose we bring this to an end for today, and you know, we'll come back to it next week.
Rep. Johnson. Mr. Chair, just a procedural question, and you know, those of us on the interim committee met what 10 times, 12 times. Put in a lot of work,
yeah.
Heard a lot of testimony, which I think certainly helped to raise the collective IQ of the committee, if you will, around the issue. It seems to me that if we're going to be able to move together collectively here, we're going to have to replicate some of that testimony for our committee so they can actually hear from the proponents and the opponents, if you will. You know, it might take us a little more time, but I think in order for us to really be able to weigh in on these concerns and so forth that the bill entails, I think we're going to really need to hear from the proponents, from the folks, from the governance as it currently exists, to those as they would like it to be, just what the
what the circumstances are like. So just a suggestion.
Unless the Senate handles all of that.
Yeah, unless you want to just abdicate to Senator Hess and just say dittos.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be very useful if we had some clear understanding of what was going to happen to that Senate bill. They may not have any clear understanding about it, which makes me...
I think we'll have a clearer sense.
One person over
there. I think we'll have a clearer sense by next week. So
be able to report on that.
Yes. Part of me groans at what you're proposing, Rep. Johnson, and then a part of me, the larger part, agrees with you. So it will be very interesting, though. I do promise you that, colleagues.
Okay.
So, but with that, I think that's enough of this interesting topic for today. So for now, we are adjourned.